Her name is Dubba Ethel Batkita Razel. Dubba Ethel Batkita Razel. Both are working? Okay, I'm ready to roll. Today is Monday, November 7th, an auspicious day, the day before the big election. This morning, some radio personality of Radio TV, Chaim Ben-Gur, who governs at my minyan every morning, asked me, Tom Erekani, my yeah. I told him I know as much as you do, so we're both in the same boat. I want to thank everyone for coming. I say hello to those in front of me. It's a difficult day. We have an epidemic in the Kollel. Everyone has the virus. So, Baruch Hashem, and I want to also thank all those listening across the wide expanse of the universe. And one second, you are a Torah Tracker boy? What's your name?
Dovi Pell.
You were here before, Dovi.
Yeah.
Am I right? If you're going to come regularly, tell me. I have to put your name on the list because I don't like teaching students in front of me who I don't know. Across the world, I can't do anything. But if you're sitting in front of me, Dovi, I want to know who you are. Now, I want to mention something that I wonder if you understand this. I'm holding in front of me an invitation to a wedding. This invitation was sent to a Chabadnik. It's a very famous name. His name is Steinsaltz, or they may have changed the name today. It's Evan Yisrael. It's the famous Rav Steinsaltz's son. Very nice couple, he and his wife. His wife is native English speaker. I think he too knows English, French, Hebrew, Yiddish. Chabadnik, he works, I think he's works in one of his father's operations, executive director. Now, this wedding invitation is to Chabadnikim, and it reads that the wedding will be in Kfar Chabad Bishaha Chachamishit Bishat Tova Umitzlachat. And then if you look on the other side, Hakupa will be Yud Aleph Macheshvan, and it tells you exactly where in Kfar Chabad Bishaa 1830. Now, what's going on here? You're having two wedding ceremonies? Does anyone know? So let me explain to you. You see, I've become a real Chabadnik. I even understand the little nuances. The Rebbe's invitation when he got married in Warsaw read that the wedding will be Bishaa Chamishit. It probably meant 5 p.m. in the afternoon. Every true Chabadnik on his wedding invitation, you follow me, Dovi, puts on Bishaa Chamishit. And then in smaller print on the side, it tells you where it will be in reality. So I just want to mention that to you. Now, another interesting, we spoke about the last week, the idea of putting on symbols on a building that will bring you home, make you remember, make you recall. So I spoke about the Ungvar Stibel in Borough Park, that it has on it, on one side, the Kotel, and the other side, Kever Rachel. Someone evidently went to Google and sends me a picture, though it doesn't show that side of the building, but here's the shul on 16th Avenue between 53rd and 54th, and that's the Ungva building. And if you walk on this side, you will see over here Kever Rachel, and over here, the Kotel. But it's amazing what you can do today. Okay. Anyway, we came back, we spoke about the whole machloket of messianicism, and David Berger attacks Chabad, the extremism, wrote a book, and in my humble opinion, Chabad owes David Berger a thank you, because he put the brakes on some of the stupidity that was happening with who the Rebbe was. However, I do want to read to you an email that I referred to last week, but I didn't yet have the email because Sherry didn't come in last Monday. Rebbe came in late. She was at the hospital in the morning with one of her children. David Eliezeri, Rabbi Eliezeri, emailed me the assertions by Dr. Berger that there is an element in Chabad that Chas V'Shalom has a belief that he calls alokistim is a lie. he cites one or two mentally ill individuals whom the community rejected and claims it's a communal trend. Nothing can be further from the truth. These false claims by Dr. Berger undermined his credibility as an objective academic. Well, those are very sharp words from Rabbi David Eliezeri, director, North County Chabad Center, and I'll add to his yichus today, he's a member of the Board of Governors of the Jewish Agency. But I'd rather take the point of view that I heard from Aaron Rakefet, that yes, there was this mishigas. It was a very, very small minority. There's no question that purple people who stated this and could kill in its name, as we know what happened to Rabbi Besvitsky, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, there's no question these were mentally ill people, but people were repeating it, people were citing it. You have instances where shuls had the picture of the Rebbe in front next to the Aron Kodesh. And I don't have to tell you, this is absolutely, totally, completely forbidden, 100%. I told you the story that in Italy, in Milano, this Americans are there, the child comes to the one day school there is, Chabad, and the teacher tells them that the Rebbe is an intermediary with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Well, I said, if that's the case, you can't trust the rabbi. Rabbi, we all eat from his hechsher, baknura wine. So these people contacted Italy, checked with the rabbi. Turned out that this lady teaching was a Catholic convert who was kakafrum, but she thinks of the Rebbe in terms of lahavdil, meyalef adalet. I don't want to mention his name. And this is way off the path. But I agree with Rabbi Eliezeri to attribute this thinking to the mainstream in Chabad is totally incorrect. Okay, and then we went on with the whole concept of the buildings, the whole concept of the replicas of 770, the red tile, very fascinating. And as I said to you last week, when I walk into Lampert Auditorium, I see the Rebbe speaking, I see thousands of people, it brings me back to some of the most precious moments in my life. And I can understand the Chabadnik. This keeps it alive, keeps the theme alive, keeps the concept alive, keeps the enash, anshei shlomenu. That's a beautiful expression. And there's no question that the idea of having these buildings, unless you could give you a list all over the world where these buildings are, it helps in perpetuating Chabad. Now, we're coming to the tail end. And again, the question haunts us. What will be? How can you keep it alive? And you have to remember what I alluded to last week. There's still thousands upon thousands, if not tens of thousands, of hundreds of thousands of people who still saw the Rebbe, who still attended a Fabrengen, who still saw Chabad in its pristine, colorful, powerful light. But what will be 50 years from now, 100 years from now? As time marches on, a Talmud sent me a link. It's unbelievable. 1952 World Series game, the seventh game, the Yankees versus the Dodgers. The whole game, someone filmed it. We're going back 1952, and there it is online. What is it, YouTube? And my Talmud sent me a link. I started to watch it. I had to turn it off. I have too much to do. All right, we'll leave it for a time when I can catch my breath at night. My mind is juvenile, and it's not ready to deal with Shas and Paiskim. But I'm looking at the movie. Black and white, so primitive, so ancient. Think what we have today. So yes, you have all the videos of the Rebbe. But just think, 50 years from now, they're going to have movies where they come out of the movies, the videos, the computer jump and kiss you and hug you and hold you up. And you can, oh, what they'll be able to do. Look what we have today. Beautiful color. Wow. And this kid will see the movies, won't even speak to him. He'll look at it black and white, ancient. Not only that, it's in Yiddish. And with all the translations underneath, once you've lost the Yiddish, once you've lost the connection, so I think these are real, real questions. What will be? Okay, a lot has been written. I'll just give you some references here. We're guessing. It's hard enough to guess the past, right? You saw those of you that have seen the Rabin Rebbe book that came out now. I just spoke with my brother. I gave my brother, I finished it. I wanted my brother's opinion because my brother is a medical doctor. He's more scientific, more rational than yours truly. My brother just told me, he teaches in medical schools, he was on the bus. He told me he loved the book. He was raving about the book. So yes, in my preface I write that we all are trying to predict the past. What was the Rebbe like in Berlin? What was the Rebbe like? And I say I also am guilty of the same charge. But it's a lot harder to predict the future than it is to predict the past. What will be? Okay. In Jewish Action, summer of 2014, I believe that's the same issue where I wrote the article on the Rebbe and the Rebbe, Jack Wertheimer has a very nice piece. Now, Jack Wertheimer is associated with the Jewish Theological Seminary. Anyone know him? I've met him at the Kotel. He came over to me. He knows some of my scholarship. Very nice fellow, and I'm positive he's a Shomer Shabbos 100%. And we've had some interesting conversations. And he wrote a very fascinating article, Why the Lubavitch Movement Thrives in the Absence of a Living Rebbe. And I have to say, he makes points here that, you see, the movement today is very organized. It's what I told you about the Institute of Jewish Learning, the Rohr Institute of Jewish Learning. They get their information, they get their coursework, they get their videos from Brooklyn. There are people in Brooklyn who work full-time for the Jewish Institute of Learning, and their job is to prepare lectures. Not every rabbi out in the world is capable of handling this. Chabadnikim, as you know, they're not the greatest lamdanim. They get smicha and they go out and shlichut. Today in YU, you see, there are guys in this kollel who are all gone at this moment. There are guys here who are 35 and they're still learning. All right, I hope they'll know something when it's all over. But Chabad, but they give them material, they're organized, they're centralized. Not only that, Chabad has a certain strength, and we've mentioned this before, and this is a big critique of Chabad. The conservative temple, the reform temple, even many, many Orthodox shuls. You come in, you want a bar mitzvah a kid, you gotta be a member. You have to be a member. Some temples will require you to be a member 2 years, 3 years. I know people, when I was in the rabbinate, they only went to a temple so they would have where to confirm their daughters or bat mitzvah their daughters and bar mitzvah their sons. Once the kids were finished, they were finished with the temple. It costs money. A temple needs support. Chabad, you got to give them credit. They'll take in any kid. You can walk in at any time. There are no requirements. There are no fees. There are no payments. That's Chabad. How do they support themselves? I'll tell you. I watched Chabad for many years. I used to go to Florida. Sunny Isles was my base. Today I go to Florida, but I'm based in Hollywood. It's a different story. Why did I go to Sunny Isles? You know what Sunny Isles is? It's below Hollywood. It's closer to Bal Harbor, closer to Miami Beach. But it's still closer to Hollywood, I would say. Fort Lauderdale, that area. So Sunny Isles, big hotel. One of the owners was a devotee of mine, a friend of mine. So he always said, whenever you come to Florida, you have to stay in the hotel. Now he's out of that business, and it's easier for me in Hollywood because I'm based there, I speak there, that's why I daven every day. Now, you go to this hotel. When I first started going there, there was no meaning, there was nothing. I had to go take my car that I rented and go 20 blocks down, and I think it was in a different area already. There was a big young Israel. And I pitied the rabbi. The rabbi is between the brackets. I'm making a comment. The rabbi said to me, you know that every rabbi suffers from his president. And I suffer more than all the rabbis because I have 100 retired presidents davening in this shul. And close the bracket. Then Chabad got involved in Sunnyside, Sunny Isles, whatever they call it, Sunny Isles, Chabad involved. And before you know it, the hotel downstairs used to have a nightclub. The nightclub is gone, everything is gone. Chabad bought the downstairs of the hotel, or leased it for 99 years, put in over $1 million and built a beautiful shul. Where did they get the money? Israelis who went into the building business, and a Chabad rabbi came in. They were traditional, weren't even that religious observant. I don't even know today how observant they are. But these are Sephardic Israelis with a traditional feeling. They loved the Chabad rabbi. He was always available. He's always with a smile. And these Israelis could put down $100,000 checks like we can write a check for $18. You understand? So when someone comes in off the street, it's not a question of money. The money is there. There are people that see the work that Chabad is doing. I told you at this retreat that I was privileged to be at, and it really was an experience because I went there a little bit hesitant. I had a quasi-feeling, is there going to be messianicism here, Mishigasia? I told you, there was one picture of the Rebbe in the whole hotel, and we're talking a hotel that's world famous, Palm Springs, one picture. And that picture was there because they were selling it for the sake, someone contributed it, painted it, and the money would go to the institute to retreat. No, a guy gets shlishi, $36,000. A guy gets shishi, $72,000. George Rush is living be well, and he gives a fortune to Chabad, gives elsewhere. You never, he's the one who established in Kehilat Jeshurun, the most famous epic making shul outside the state of Israel, the Luxtein dynasty. He established a minyan for beginners. He gets, they tell me, 250 people, 250 Shabbos morning. He conducts it. What an individual. He flew in to speak in his private jet, flew out 4 a.m. the next morning. He left a few million dollars for the year. He covers the budget. He, his friends, that's Chabad. So, of course, Wertheimer makes the point that when you have a shul that anyone can walk into and no one's going to say no to you, and the rabbi and the rebbetzin are accommodating and our personalities and are filled with warmth and outreach, and that's their life, and they're there for life, that will continue. And you know, you have to compare it to an ordinary rabbinic. I plead guilty. I was in the rabbinate. All right, I'm a different person today. I have to admit it. But when I got back in 1961, Dovi, I had one goal in life, to make every Jew in the United States a Shomer Shabbos. That was my goal. I went into the rabbinate, and I wanted to build a reputation, and I wanted to conquer. And then you want to move on to a bigger shtetl, to a bigger shtetl. Ultimately, every rabbi wants to be in Brooklyn, wants to be in Manhattan, wants to be in Queens. That's where it's at. Today, Staten Island is also on the map. All right, if you can't make it in New York, you want to be in Chicago, you want to be in Los Angeles, you don't want to be in Timbuktu. Chabadnik comes, he stays, the shul is life is the shul. So Wertheimer makes a very, very good point. Then there's another issue which we touched upon, and I wanted to spell it out, and I'll also give you a source for it. David Eliezer, in his book on Chabad, it's an excellent book, by the way, some very good material has come out on Chabad. With the 20th anniversary of the Rebbe's death, the three biographies, and David Eliezer's book on the inner workings of Chabad. And what's amazing about these books, these are Chabadnikim, but they write in a very balanced fashion that even a Litvak can read it and not feel that they're writing in a sense of Kabbalah and esotericism and something above and beyond the Ruach HaKodesh. It's written with their feet on the ground. And here, a very fascinating question. Look what's happening in Chabad. And Harry Merrilis, let me just tell you who Harry Merrilis is. Anyone recognize the name? the website, MSV Amuna, Harry Merrilis. So Harry Merrilis, a Herschel Merrilis from Chicago, happened to have met him. A wonderful individual, a Talmud of Rabban Soloveitchik, Smicha, but he didn't go into the rabbin. He went into business, and he ever retired at a fairly young age, and he devotes himself to his website. It must be 10 years already. He's younger than I am. I would estimate him early 70s, perhaps I'm wrong, but that age range, 70. And very insightful. It's worth seeing him. He always has something to say. You can agree or disagree. 90% of the time I agree with him. He's coming from a Baron Soloveitchik. I'm more of a hawk than he is vis-a-vis Israel. He's more dovish, which is interesting, because being a Talmud of Rabban Soloveitchik, he should be more hawkish than I am, if you know the players here. But very insightful. And if you go to Emetri Amuna and type in Chabad, centrist orthodoxy, a number of times he has dealt with it, and he makes the point that Eliezer is alluding to, and it's a point that I have to say I see with my own eyes is absolutely correct. And the point is very simple. Chabad is becoming an orthodoxy that's light, centrist. It's not like a regular Orthodox Jew. Well, what does that mean? You go into the big cities and you take, when I was growing up, you had Orthodox Jews. I referred to it yesterday. Some of the people here, we had a big crowd yesterday. Some of the people confirmed what I was saying. We had Orthodox Jews. How many Orthodox Jews did you have? Echveis, 1 out of 10, if that many. Why did people come to Orthodox Jews? Because their parents stopped in an Orthodox shul. This was a shul. My father, who was born in Harlem, my mother born in Harlem, they had tremendous respect for Jews with beards and rabbinic clothing. And they didn't know much about Yiddishkeit, but they had that feeling. It was ingrained within them from childhood. My mother came from a family of 6. The other 5 totally assimilated. My mother had feeling her home was always kosher, and there was respect for Rabbanim. No concept of halacha, no concept of what Yiddishkeit is all about, until their sons educated them. But you came into a shul, like I said yesterday, 6 o'clock, 6:30 in the morning was the first minyan, or 6 o'clock. By 8 o'clock, everyone was finished. They made kiddush, went home, changed their clothes, went to work. Everyone worked. I remember, I write about it, I think in Washington, I don't know if I spelled it out, but there was a man in my house, the Yudapayish. It was a big building I lived in, Washington and 180th Street in the Bronx. Normie Gold went back today. I'm afraid to go there, forget about by night, even by day. And Normie said to me, I don't want to tell you his words, but Rebbe, if anything happens to me, it's not terrible. He went back and took pictures. The picture that appears on the cover of Washington is a picture, I thank Norman Gold, if you look inside, Dr. Norman Gold, for taking the picture. And where we grew up, this was the norm. This man lived in my building around the side. He was a Yudapayish Talmud Chacham. Shabbos, he would come back from work, and I would go to his house. I was friendly with his sons, who went to TA. He was learning a Daf Gemara. I never had a question in Gemara. I couldn't ask my father, but I could ask this individual. That was the way we grew up. Then World War II came in, the refugees came in, and like Charlie Hexter, he's an example. A Yekka from Washington Heights, 99% of the people davening in your shul were Shomer Shabbos, of course. 99, maybe 100%, but I will say 99. Today you go in Young Israel. At that time the rule was you could only be an officer in Young Israel if you were Shomer Shabbos. Do you remember that, Mark? Today, 99% of every Young Israel is Shomer Shabbos. You go into an Orthodox shul in New York, in Boston, in Cleveland, in Chicago, in Baltimore, in Los Angeles, 80% of the people are Shomer Shabbos. You go into a Chabad shtibl. It's, if you have a minyan Shomer Shabbos, you're doing well. David Eliezeri, who built Chabad Orange County, that's right beneath the Los Angeles area, I think 30 Chabad shuls, more or less, in that area. I don't know of one Chabad shul that has a minyan of Shemesh Shabbos. And Rabbi Eliezri said to me, he's married to my student Stella, we've become very close, we're like kindred spirits, we appreciate each other. And David said to me, when I succeed in making a family from, they leave, either they go to Brooklyn or they go on Aliyah to Israel. You follow? You make a family from, and you lose the family. And yet, Yantif and Shabbos, the shul thrives, alive, kicking. He was telling me, Malka had a classmate, I don't want to mention the family, from Gedolei Israel, a Ramaz kid. Generally in Ramaz, the women more or less remained from, and the men who went there in the 40s and the 50s, Nishke Bribera Brekel Yiddishkeit. And this guy used to drive the shul on Shabbos, and he was his Bal Korei in the shul. He's no longer alive. Malka's classmate. And Rabbi Eliezer told me a story. Dovi, it's unbelievable. That one time, a policeman stops him on Shabbos. He was speeding, went through a stop sign. When they give you a ticket in that county, you have to sign when you receive it. He refused to sign. It's the Sabbath. And this is a true story. So Eliezer makes the point, and Keshu Merilis makes the point that he says what's developing in America, you have right-wing orthodoxy, the black hats, what we call here Haredim, then you have YU, Young Israel, OU, where 90% of the people are Shomrei Shabbos, Shomrei Torah and Mitzvah. And then you have a Chabad set up where the rabbi is Chabad, all the Rabbanim have beards, all the Rabbanim wear black, dress in black, wear a Bekashim in Shabbos, even if during the week they wear regular suits, on Shabbos they dress exactly like the Rebbe dressed, they all wear gatels, and 90% of their balabatim are Mechalalei Shabbos. You understand? Very interesting comment. Now, I want to read Rakefet's take on this. I believe this to be absolutely true. But and you see it on Shabbos. I read to you, I showed you. You have a Chabad shul. People are driving, people are coming, people are parking. Remember, I cited Eisenberg, that Israeli entrepreneur who visits Long Island. Friday night there's a come a minyan. And Shabbos morning when there's a kiddush and a cholent and a kugel in a Chabad place, it's a mob scene. Endless cars. Is it good? Is it bad? All right, we can debate the issue. It's not for now. But I'll tell you what the advantage is. In a Chabad shul, the people may be irreligious, but they will never tell the rabbi what to do. It's very fascinating. I was re-elected my first shtela. I got my face kicked in. Very difficult. I was 23 years of age. I was a hotshot from the yeshiva. I was considered a Talmud Chacham. I had two masters already. I was on my taking courses towards my doctorate. I was a Talmud Mufak of Mori Urebi, Rav Soloveitchik, the Rav. I tremble when I mention his name. And it's all true. And then I came into my first shtela and I got killed. And it was a very difficult year. It could have made me or could have broken me. All right, Ani Modala Kadosh Baruch Hu. It turned me into a different person, and it serves me well until today. Because some of you know me well, and you know that I'm an individual without an ego. It's a terrific feeling. You never have to worry. People can spit in your face, and you just tell them thanks for the seltzer. It's terrific, and that's why I'm sitting here. If I would have had an ego, you have no idea the jobs that were offered to me, the money that was offered to me over the decades in Israel. I would have been world famous with such titles. Oh, a dean, a president, a Rosh Yeshiva, a this, a that. And I turned it all down, and it's a result of 61, because what do I need it for? All I can do is learn, study, be machadesh, and teach. and I never wanted to give up. I could have been a Chaver Knesset. I mean, I don't have to tell you, imagine a Chaver Knesset. Who knows, I would become a Sah, be Memshelet Yisrael with a shofar. Oh boy. All right. When all that is said, I was re-elected to the position. I think it was a vote of 9-7. You can look in Washington, get the exact details. Charlie Liebman. Did you know Charlie Liebman? You didn't know him. Charlie Liebman, Zichrono Livracha, was a balabas in my shul in Lower Merion, and Ballykinwood, Lower Merion Synagogue, 61-62. And he saw what was going on. And he did an ingenious article that made him world famous, a sociological study of orthodoxy in the United States. It appeared in Judaism in the early 60s. If anyone wants a copy, I have copies I'll be happy to give you. And he appendixes a case study where he talks about a young rabbi. I always told my students, cross out young rabbi and put in the name Aaron Rothkopf. I'm the young rabbi, and he analyzes who voted for me and who voted against me. Now watch. The majority of the people who voted for me were in Shomer Shabbos. But they didn't get involved with halacha. If the rabbi said it's kosher, it's kosher. If it's not kosher, it's not kosher. The rabbi is the expert. He observes Shabbos. He observes kosher. We do the little bit that we do. But we're never going to tell the rabbi, this is kosher, this is not. The people who voted against me, it's the wine incident. What happened in the president's house, my second Shabbat there, the president, a YU graduate, made a reception for me to welcome the new rabbi. It was a young shul, I'm the second rabbi. They faced their 50 families. Who would dream today it's the center of Yiddishkeit in all of Pennsylvania, Lower Merion. The rabbi made Kiddush. And they give me whatever wine we had then. Remember, I grew up until today. I have no taste for wine. Just Concord wine, Malaga, sweet wine. What did we have? And these are wines. Yeah, all right, I made Kiddush. Yes, I made Kiddush. The president says to me, Rabbi, turn away. This is not for you. And in front of all the people, he breaks out a bottle of French wine. You know, that's the type of wine today that wins prizes out of Israel. But then it was French wine. What do I do? This is in public. Well, I got to tell you, until today, we've never served. I've spoken with great people, important people. What do you do? It's in public. If it's in private, it's one thing. Public. So I said, Leon, that wine is not kosher. Why, you got a letter that week. Get this Rabbi Rothkopf out of here. He's a moron. He's an extremist. Now, Chabad, the average rabbi, you're on the rabbinate. No. Rabbi, we want to pass the Torah to the women's section. What's wrong with it? Balabatim. They know how to learn. What's wrong? They do it here, they do it there. This rabbi permits it. Rabbi Riskin permits it. What's wrong? Rabbi, the mechitza is too big. The women can't see. Too opaque. Come on, we can have a 60-inch mechitza. All right, Rabbi Soloveitchik even permitted 50 inches. Of course, they don't say when you had no choice. But all right, Rabbi Soloveitchik did. True, absolutely. The whole machlokes, I've spoken about it in class years ago. What's the purpose of a mechitza? Rabbi Soloveitchik held it's to establish reshuyot. So 50 inches is enough, like any mechitza. 10 tefachim. Rav Moshe held there shouldn't be physical contact. He required 60, 65 inches. The Sakhmu Ruv and Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook held men shouldn't see each other. 72 inches required. All right. Fine. Do you understand what I'm saying? There's, in a Chabad shul, there's one tremendous advantage that the rabbi has. The Balabatim are not going to tell him what to do. This is the shul, this is the rabbi. And I have to tell you, I have a first cousin. Again, Nishtabrekel Yiddishkeit, what her parents, or her father, her mother was my mother's sister, but her father came to myself and a from people who were still observant in America. My mother already came from a family where kashrut remained, but Shabbos already was knocked in. She goes to Chabad. I couldn't believe it. She goes Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah. They go to Chabad. And they know in advance, the shul belongs to the rabbi, the rabbi's in charge of ritual, no one's going to vote against Aaron Rothkopf back in 61 because he said the wine is treif. That's his domain. Follow me? So it's an interesting point. And are they really centrist? What will really happen? Time will tell. I don't want to predict the future. If you ask me to put money on it, what will be 100 years from now? I think there'll still be a very, very strong Chabad. It won't have any messianicism in it. It'll be much more normative, and it becomes a branch of Hasidut unto itself. Back to the wine story, Dovi. I want to tell you, the person who's insulted, and the president and the chairman of the board, these very important people, don't want to mention names, but we're dealing with YU graduates who were world famous and very important at that moment in time. And boy, they thought I was a fanatic to the 50th power. Interestingly, the person whose house had offered me the wine became a tzaddik yesod olam. He's alive today in his 90s, should live and be well. And they told me the story. He had a bout with cancer. And he made a deal with the Ribbono Shel Olam that if he recovers, he's going to take his religion seriously. He recovered and he kept his word. I once stopped with him years ago, but many years after 61, I couldn't believe it. Talis Ibrim Kup, every word, and that's when I was told the story. He's in his 90s today, a frum Jew, 100%. So I want to thank him for the wine incident, because it made a mensch out of me, although I realize it could have destroyed me. It was not so simple. I went crying to the Rav, and I've said this many times, and the Rav spoke with me and comforted me and told me over from Reb Chaim, I think I write this in Washington, or in the Rav, I think in Washington I write it, and he says, in the name of Zayda, if a Rav was medunish for a reistreiben from Stadt, a simnes nishta Rav, and if a lassish a reistreiben, simnes nishta mensch. A rabbi who they don't want to throw out of the city, it's a sign he's not a good rabbi. And if he lets himself be thrown out, it's a sign he's not a strong man. It's nishta mensch. Later in my own research, I got to know very well that the Rav was not expressing sympathy to me. It was empathy. You know what the difference is. Sympathy is, all right, you're nice to someone, but you never really suffered. It's sympathy to someone else. Empathy means I really understand what you're going through. And if you recall Rakepit's research on the Rav in the 30s into the 40s with the Kashrut scandal, what I write about in the Rav and why in the documentary what everyone talks about, what the Rav went through in Boston in the Rabbinate is indescribable. And that's why the Rav was willing in 44 to go to Chicago to be the Rosh Yeshiva in Skokie, accept their offer, and leave the Rabbinate altogether. So it's very, very fascinating. And here I'll tell you a story in brackets. Those of you that were here Tuesday night at the book launch, right? Tuesday night. So you saw, I was amazed. We had a very nice crowd because this place is not that accessible. It's not the OU Center in the center of the city. But I insisted on the book launch being here out of cupboard for this Shurim I gave in this building in the book, and out of cupboard for Chris Kollel, I wanted the book launch to be here. So you didn't know all the people in the crowd, but there was one man sitting there in his early 90s who is a Bostonian. not only a Bostonian, Joey Abelow, it's his father who brought the Rav to Boston. And it's his father who kept the Rav in Boston when he wanted to leave in 44. His father, Abelow, was a Slabotka Talmud Chacham and a businessman in America who struggled but survived. Shemesh Shabbos, kids from, and Joey was here, his wife is not well, but came out that evening, and I inscribed the book to him with a special inscription thanking him for his help in the Rav. What was his help with my research on the Rav? There's a footnote, I quote him. Had a very big problem. The Kashrut scandal got so bad that the Attorney General of Massachusetts, Brooknell, decided he's going to set up a committee to check it out, and he put a retired judge in charge. The retired judge's name was, and this is the way everyone quotes him later, their articles on apartheid. It's the only time the conservative rabbi wrote an article on apartheid that they published. It was an article about the Rav, a great admirer of the Rav, Shubo, Rabbi Shubo, conservative rabbi, wrote a whole article after the decision came in, after 2 years of investigation. So everyone quotes the judge, A.K. Cohn. Well, when you're writing scholarship, you want to write a first name. You can write a K as a middle name, but you try to get a first name. So I asked Dr. Tova Lichtenstein, with this judge, he said to me, Aaron, we never knew his first name. Everyone referred to him as A.K. A.K. So I contacted Joey Abelow. He was still living in Boston. And I asked Joey, go in every judiciary system, there's a place where they keep their records, their files. Go in and see if there's anything there. And he went, and he told me the story. He comes into this building, all files, all the law books, all the law, lawyers, whatnot, and right downstairs, information, and a big Afro-American woman is sitting there, and he goes over to her and he says, I'm looking for information on a certain legal investigation with Rabbi Soloveitchik. And she pops up, she says, oh, you mean the Kashrut investigation? You didn't have to say a second word. The name was Abraham Kalman Cohn. A.K. Abraham K. Cohn. And he was a Reformed Jew, but he came from good stock, and he became very close to the Rav. Tova told me every year before Rosh Hashanah, he used to come and drink a l'chaim with the Rav and ask for a bracha. And you know, he was very forthright that not only did the Rav not do anything wrong, but he was a tzaddik, he said, with money, a tzaddik, he said, all right, it's a terrible story. I just saw in the book, the Rav and the Rebbe, he's not clear on who made the charges, but you should know the charges were made by people who wanted in on the kashrut, the supervision. One of them was a very important rabbi, a Yudapeish Talmud Chacham, an Eloi, and he made charges against the Rav. Later, he got into trouble with IRS on not declaring income. The Rav went out of his way to use his political connections to keep this other rabbi out of jail. Now, I was criticized why I don't mention the rabbi's name. There was a piece done on Rakefet, a 90-page article in a fest strip of Professor at Bar-Ilan on Rakefet scholarship. The guy knows what I wrote better than I do, but okay. And he criticizes me why I don't mention the rabbi's name. So I recorded an answer to him. There are other things there. I just wanted to set the record straight. He claims I became more Haredi over the years because my first book was published by JPS, my next book by Feldheim. It has nothing to do with being Haredi, not Haredi. If anyone knows me, when I came in Aliyah, I didn't know where I was going. I was, you know, torn between worlds. Here I became a real B'nai Akivanik. I appreciated everything B'nai Akiva did for me. I became a real religious. So I asked a few students to come upstairs in the conference room. I think it was 8:30, I would record an answer. And I want them sitting in front of me so it's easier for me to speak, because you don't want to speak without a few people in the room. So I recording the answer. And I say, and you ask why I don't mention the name? You're right, I should mention the name. Nothing wrong with it. The man did cause the Rav great harm, and afterward the Rav was Maisa Nefesh to help him. I should have mentioned. But I don't want to embarrass people. Let them mention the name 100 years from now. I said, sitting in front of me, smiling at me, is the grandson of the rabbi who caused the Rav all this Achmas Nefesh. He's right here. If you see this picture, standing in front of the Mir Yeshiva, it says, Talmud Shagalam Maglin Rabbo Imo. That's the grandson of the rabbi. This is Rabbi Leib Ayans, soon to be Rabbi Dr. Leib Ayans from Toronto, my dear Talmud. Why should I embarrass him? Okay. Now, in his book, The Secret of Chabad by David Eliezeri, he has an amazing description towards the end of what the Rebbe really valued in life. And I want to read this description to you. I was in the room. As I told you, I know Leib Groner very well, and I got a beautiful tour, not only from Leibel, but from the head of the library, Rabbi Dov Ber Levine. I got a very beautiful tour of the inner workings of Chabad in the last maybe 10 years ago. I'm reading from page 339. Since his arrival in the United States in 1941, the Rebbe occupied an office on the first floor of 770. Now, 770, how many of you have been there? How many of you have seen the structure? Nothing to get excited about. Years ago, I remember, it may have been at a Fabreng, and I forget, there was a Jew that came in from, I don't know, someplace out of America, and for the first time he's at 770. Well, must have been a Rav. Looked like a Rav. Beard. Rabbinic garb. And I remember he was saying, this is Chabad, this is Lubavitch. Yeah, what the heck? He thought, you know, it should be a building, a block square. And he was going, it's a converted mansion. Then they knocked together, they got two mansions, three mansions. They knocked the walls out. But it's no more than a converted mansion that was on Eastern Parkway, which was the center of Judaism in America. Brooklyn, in the late 30s, early 40s. So he occupied a little office, first floor. Bookshelves lined the walls. Piles of books the Rebbe was using in his study stood in columns around the room. Boxes were filled with letters and material. All right? In the earlier years, when the Rebbe received visitors for private appointments, the books would be covered or removed from the room. In the later years, when the private meetings ceased, the office became filled with endless books and documents. If I can say it in English, in Yiddish, skivena hegdish. You know what that expression means, a hegdish? Anyone know? Hegdish, Yiddish. A big mess. Why does the word come from hegdish? Yeah, but what's it talking about? In the shuls in Europe, always next to the shul, there was one room for wayfarers, where you could sleep, where you could cook, where you could eat, where you could drink. It was always a mess. That's how the expression came in Yiddish, is given, it was a hegdish. Like you said, Murray, what does hegdish mean? Kadosh, it was part of the shul, but it was a hegdish. That was the Rebbe's office. Rabbi Binyamin Klein, that's one of the three closest to the Rebbe, Binyamin Klein, Yehuda Krinsky, and Leibel Groner. Rabbi Binyamin Klein, the Rebbe's secretary, describes when the Rebbe was studying, he would open a book to a page, set it aside, open another book, pile one on top of another. Someone described that to me with the Rebbe, that when he was preparing the Yotzei Drasha, His whole living room, every chair would have books open on it, and he would be walking from one to one to one, checking and then writing his ideas. Klein explained, just before Shabbos, the Rebbe would cover the books on with a paper, and on Sunday, remove them and begin again, creating more piles. Finally, the secretary suggested to the Rebbe, let's expand the office. We'll knock down the walls and expand it. You'll have more room. The Rebbe responded, my father-in-law, the Rebbe, gave me this room and that's where I want to be, rejecting any idea to expand the office. Just after Pesach in 1991, the Rebbe spent 6 weeks organizing his office. Rabbi Krinsky says, quote, it was apparent that the Rebbe was creating a new order to the point that the room was almost empty. Klein says, during the period when the Rebbe was organizing the books and materials in his office, some were sent to the library, others to archives, and some material was destroyed. The Rebbe's secretaries had been troubled by this change. Rabbi Groner said, quote, this was not business as usual. After the Rebbe completed the reorganization, he would no longer retain the books he used in his studies for extended periods of time. Each time he would promptly return the book to the Chabad library. 9 months after cleaning his office, the Rebbe suffered a debilitating stroke, which robbed him of his speech, caused his left side to be paralyzed. We all remember this, I trust. On the Rebbe's desk, a calendar and a few other items were left. The most prominent space was taken up by the large, oversized volumes of the Sefer HaShluchim. Each page featured a series of pictures of the families of Shluchim, husbands and wives with their children. The pictures were organized according to states and countries. Interlaced with the family pictures were images of Chabad institutions around the world. Now, have you ever seen the Sifrei Shluchim? It's worth seeing. The library of Chabad is right above Me'ez Sharim as you come down the hill that leads to Me'ez Sharim. It's called the Gutnik Library. Ask anyone in that area where it is. They'll show it to you. What's the story of the Sefer Shluchim? The Sefer Shluchim was published on the Rebbe's initiative. At the Shluchim Convention in October of 1990, the Rebbe asked that an album be prepared of all the Shluchim in the world, their children and pictures of institutions, and the Rebbe suggested it should be ready in 3 weeks. You know what this means? When I suggest, this is not a Rosh Yeshiva speaking, it's Chassidic Rebbe. Rabbi Yosef Friedman, the project editor, says, quote, the Rebbe loves souvenir journals, starting with the journals he himself published in the 40s of the work of the Merkaz L'Inyonei Chinuch and Mesibas Shabbos, Mesibat Shabbat. Later, the rabbi encouraged books in honor of the public menorah lightings. The Shluchim project was massive. It was at the very early stages of desktop publishing with what we can do with computers, and there was no email. We had to collect thousands of images from around the world, making sure they were print quality and listing thousands of names and getting it right. It was quite a challenge. The actual printing was done in China. One member of the editorial staff, Rabbi Shaya Gansberg, spent months in Hong Kong overlooking production. At first, 3 volumes were published, one for the U.S. and Canada, second for Israel, the third for the rest of the world. A year later, a 4th volume was published. Although it included Shluchim in 37 countries, 39 states, in the 4th volume there was an extensive index in Hebrew and English, listing over 14,000 names of those who appeared in the books. My kids still remember the excitement of getting dressed in their best Shabbos clothes and going to a photographer in the local mall to take these pictures. The Rebbe said it was essential to include pictures of all of the children, saying, quote, they will be inspired by seeing their pictures in the book, giving them encouragement to go in the right path when they grow older as well. It was these pictures that encouraged Rabbi Israel New, whose parents are shluchim in Atlanta, to follow in their footsteps. He was just 7 when the book was published. As a child, he would look at the pictures and feel that he was part of a lofty and noble endeavor. He says there was a tremendous sense of belonging and pride that he is part of the second generation of Chabad. And then the editorial staff proposed to the Rebbe that it should be dedicated in memory of Rebbe Simchaya Mushka, the Rebbe's wife. We weren't sure if the Rebbe would agree, but when we received the Rebbe's approval, it was clear that the album was being treated as a family album. And just think, the Rebbe, his wife, full page dedication, he had no children, but he had 4 tremendous volumes filled with pictures of his shulchan. That's what remained on his desk. Rabbi Ezri writes, I realized that the Rebbe considered the shluchim his family on the day his wife passed away. Upon being informed of her passing, the first request the Rebbe made was that the shluchim should be informed. I, as many others, hastily flew through the night to New York. He was in Los Angeles, in the California area, Orange County. Shortly after the funeral, the word went out that the shluchim were invited to join the Rebbe for Mincha in his home. Hasidim had always respected the Rebbe's privacy, and for almost all of us, on that sorrowful afternoon, it was the first time we were in the Rebbe's home. Outside on the street, a crowd of hundreds and later thousands gathered. Only the shluchim and a few distinguished elderly Hasidim were admitted into the house. We'd waited downstairs, standing on the simple wooden floor in the living room. Finally, the Rebbe came down the winding staircase. There were 50, maybe 60 of us from across the globe. We stood in a semicircle as the Rebbe walked to the Amid, a simple wooden podium where he rested his prayer book. I was just a foot or so away as he led the prayers. Never before had I felt so deeply connected. It was the shluchim that he wanted next to him at this moment of his great loss. At that instant, I understood we, the shluchim, are the Rebbe's family. And you can understand the scene, the sight. Rabbi Krinsky says, quote, the Rebbe loved the Sefer HaShluchim. During the difficult period of illness after the Rebbe broke, Rabbi Krinsky would at times sit with the Rebbe late into the night reviewing the Sefer HaShluchim. Rabbi Krinsky says he could see the nachat, the enjoyment the Rebbe received from seeing the pictures of the shluchim and their children. On the day of his stroke, the Rebbe's office was unusually neat. The piles of books had been organized and returned to the library. Personal papers and years of correspondence had been archived or removed. On that fateful day, on the center of his desk, was the Sefer Hashluchim, whose large volumes filled with the images of his family, the thousands of men, women, and children whom he inspired to dedicate their lives to the welfare of the Jewish people and care of others. The desk remains that way until today. In its center, the Book of Shluchim, the Rebbe's legacy and gift to the world. All right? I don't think any other comment is necessary. Just excuse me. I think that chapter says it all. But I want to go a step further. And I want to ask a very basic question. It's a litvak. Very basic question. Tell me, if Chassidus is so basic to Torah, how come it's only revealed at such a much later stage in life? What are we talking about? The 1700s? 1740, 1750, the Baal Shem Tov. 1780, 1790, the Alter Rebbe, the Maggid of Mezrich, the Lubavitcher dynasty. What's going on here? Shas, Paiskim, it all along. Torah Shebechtav. If Chassidus is so important, why did it have to wait so many thousands of years for the Baal Shem Tov to come along? Remember, we spoke about this decades ago when I spoke about the history of Torah in modern times. The Baal Shem Tov's dream on Rosh Hashanah, where he meets Mashiach and says to Mashiach in the words of the Gemara in Chelek, Sanhedrin, "May Eimatai Ka'atima, when will you reveal yourself?" And the Mashiach answers him, "Ad sheyafutzu mayinotecha chutzah, when you spread your teachings, ultimately it will reveal me." Why did we have to wait so long? If it's part of Torah, should have been Torah Shabbat there. Why wait thousands of years? All right, I ask it as a litvak, but the Rebbe's outstanding student. This is called Or V'Chiyut. It's Mibeit Mayanotecha, published here in Israel. I'm quoting the special publication of Or V'Chiyut that they gave out 1 year ago in honor of Yud Tet Kislev. Wonderful question. Rabbi Yoel Cohn, the great Gong HaChassid, Rabbi Yoel Cohn, the Chose of the Rebbe, this is Rabbi Yoel Cohn, he's the leading Hasidic mind in the world today. Gong Adir. Not a young man, but he's been in Israel, he spoke. He might have even been here for the Yud Tet Kislev, for the Chagiga, for the Hitvadut, for the Fabregin. He may have been the main speaker this year. I dimly recall that he was here. Rabbi Yoel, everyone knows the name, Rabbi Yoel Cohn. So, he has an article here, Hitgadlet Toret Chassidut Bedorot HaAchronim. And he says something, I'm going to make a comparison in a few minutes, but he says something very, very powerful. Chassidus was very privileged, very secretive. You only reveal it to the chosen few. It's part of the esoteric Kabbalistic tradition. Maisa Bereshit, Maisa Merkava, Shin Barabin. And really, it's been with us all along. You have traces, Chassidus quotes Midrashim, quotes Gemaras, quotes Agada. The links are there. But it never took on a tangible fashion until the Baal Shem Tov. Why? And here he says so beautifully, the Ribbono Shel Olam saw the generation was ready to fall apart, to disappear. What the Jews went through, the Khmelnytsky massacres, 1648, 1655, what the Jews went through with the false Shabbatai Tzvi messianicism. Remember, people were so excited. Read the memoir of Gluckel of Halman, which is an amazing memoir, written by a lady who knew how to write, and she was a business lady. She was a widow at an early age, and she had to take over the business and run the family, or she wouldn't survive. Messiah announced himself. Shabtai Tzvi. Jews sold all their belongings, packed everything up, got ready for a trip to Eretz Yisrael. Right or wrong, memoir literature tells the truth, doesn't lie. Written with no political purpose, just to say it as it was. And then it turns out that it was false. He was not Messiah. And how disappointed the people were, and how they started leaving Yiddishkeit, those who still believed in Shabbat Tzvi, and the Frankist, which was a combination of Judaism, Catholicism, and terrible, terrible behavior, everything going wild. And at that time, 1700s already, the seeds of enlightenment are in the world. The enlightenment that we struggle with until today, that so many tens of millions of Jews have willingly and wantonly thrown away their heritage, have been traitors to the blood in their veins. I don't have to go any further than Kerry, Secretary of State, who really is Cohn, a great, great, great grandson of Rabbeinu Yehuda, the brother of the Maral Prague. And this is modern times. This is where we're at. God have mercy. How many Jews assimilate, intermarry, cut themselves off, the spiritual silent Holocaust in addition to the Hitler Holocaust. And he says, the Ribbono Shel Olam understood that if he doesn't allow the Baal Shem Tov to reveal Hasidus, the Jews would be lost forever. It was Eit Lasot Lashem Heferu Torah Techa. Recognize it? It was Horaat Sha'ah that had to be Pikuach Nefesh Shel Am Yisrael. Tell me, who gave this very same explanation to a very similar question? Powerful question? Powerful answer? Yes or no? Powerful answer. Same question, similar, same answer. Mori Urebi, Rabbi Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik. Mori Urebi traveled a long path in his life. Everyone who studies Rabbi Soloveitchik is being mefaltel and lecturing and saying and doing and going. How did the Rav leave Agudat Yisrael, become a Mizrachiite? I've also have had a few words to say on this topic. Good question. But World War II taught the Rav, if there wouldn't be a state of Israel, the Jewish people would not have survived. Mori and Rebbe asked, why did God grant us this gift of the state of Israel? What are we, frumer than earlier generations? What are we, more tzaddikim? What are we, more medaktek in mitzvah? What are you talking about, earlier generation? Who saw Mechalo Shabbos in Eastern Europe before 1900? Germany, all right, went by the wayside. But Eastern Europe, who saw Mechalo Shabbos? I quote Rebbe now. I think I have it in the Rav. Word by word, from a Yotzach Shah, I remember a time where everyone was Shema Shabbos. He said, in the shtetl where I grew up, the only Mechalo Shabbos was the doctor and the pharmacist. They worked on Shabbos, and the doctor wasn't a doctor, and the pharmacist didn't know what he was doing as a pharmacist. Quote, end quote. After World War I, Shabbos was rampant. All over. We speak of Warsaw, we speak of Vilna. We're already talking where the barricades were burst, were broken, were depleted, had fallen down. Then the Holocaust. Any survivor of the Holocaust was ashamed to say he was a Jew. You all know that. How many children were not circumcised later when they became balei tshuva, which is the wrong word to use, when they returned to their real being, they had to be circumcised. People were ashamed. This is an absolute fact. The Rav said there would have been no Jews left. But God gave us a great gift, the state of Israel. It awakened Jewish identity. The New York Times had to write about Jewish topics. They were so anti being a Jew, so assimilated. Who were they? The leaders of Reform Judaism. And Baruch Hashem, the state of Israel, woke up hundreds of thousands, millions of Jews afterwards, to their Jewish identity. God had no choice. It's not that we deserved it, not that we were more righteous, not that we were more pedantic in our observance, not that we were more learned, not that we were more committed than earlier generations, chas v'chalila. But we were one step above annihilation, and we needed the state of Israel to wake us up. And on this level, it's amazing. The answer of Rabbi Yoel Cohen and the answer of the Rav to a similar question are absolutely one and the same. And Rabbi Yoel Cohen gives us a source, you can see it inside, that the Talmidim of the Baal Shem Tov argued, you're revealing too much, one Rebbe said to another. Not allowed to reveal so much. Keep it a secret. Public. And the other Rebbe answered, we have to do it, or the Jewish people will be lost. Assimilated, brokenhearted, Shabtai Tzvi, Chmelnytsky massacres, poverty. Where do we go from here? We have to reveal it. And you have to understand, Hasidus became a mass movement. Not that every Hasid is a Lamdin or every Hasid is a Tzaddik, but Hasidim. They drink a L'chaim, they tell wonder stories of the Rebbe, they connected once again. They didn't get lost. And you see, after World War II, hard to conceive of the miracle that happened here. Even the Rav couldn't conceive of it. I told you many times, you have it on tape, we're at Moria, the Rav and the Agadah, because he ended off every shir with Parshanut, homiletics, a bit of Agadah, Hashkafa, livened up the audience. And he made the comment that in America we rebuilt literature learning, I have told him, but Hasidus haven't rebuilt here. And some Jew from the audience challenged the Rav, and the Rav shot back at him, "No, I'm correct. How do I know I'm correct? Where do your children learn? They learn with me in Yeshiva University. Litvish, Yeshiva Service Kochanim. Rabbi couldn't conceive of what would happen. This was in the 50s, what I'm quoting. And the Rav many times came back and said, all right, it's not the same Hasidus like in Europe with the devotion and dedication. He sort of felt the Hasidim here were clones, but not total clones. You know, they were Americanized, money, business, work, diamonds. But when all is said and done, Hasidus is here. Look what they rebuilt. Look at the numbers. Look at the rebellion, look at the power, look at the dedication, look at the state of Israel. Just think for a minute, the Bnei Brak, branches in Ashdod, Yerushalayim, Ger, bells. It's unbelievable. You go into the bells, it's like a Beit HaMikdash. Have you ever gone on a tour of the bells in North Yerushalayim? It's like the Beit HaMikdash. You can't believe what goes on there. Have you ever seen the shul yet? It's the biggest shul in Israel. And you know the way the seats work. Every seat is sold. I was in England, in Hendon, in the home of a wealthy Jew. His father was a survivor. Bells succeeded them. This man bought a seat in Bells, whatever place, $100,000. He has a tremendous picture in his house of that seat in the bell shtetl. And he stares at it, he looks at it. How many times does he ask bells? Then they're smarter. They sell the seat again to an Israeli who can't afford $100,000. He gives $10,000. He uses the seat. If that other man should come, he gets it. Then you know what goes on with the bells of Yingelach, the Yungelite, the students in the Bells institutions, they have a computer printout to get into the main shul, a place which holds 2,000. I never saw such a big shul in my life. And they give a clock, they have a banger, the Rebbe Talmud, oh my, and have a computer printout. Each Talmud is allowed in for 20 minutes to daven near the Rebbe. And those seats, there are certain seats that every 20 minutes a different person is dying. Then they have to go back to the other various minyanim in the building. Who could believe it? Well, we were near total assimilation, and Hasidus came and saved us. And exactly what the Rav said about the state of Israel. I needn't elaborate how many stories you have here of Chayalim Bodedim, who came from nothing with no background, and they wake up to their Yiddishkeit. And I have to tell you, on a personal level, I have a simcha this Thursday night in Zichron Yaakov. A grandson is getting engaged. Baruch Hashem. No, I have various families. In this family, English is not a priority. I have other families where they insist the kids have to learn English and speak English. And these kids, they're all the children are totally integrated, but to some English is a value, to some not. And Erev Sukkos, my grandson, gave the girl a ring and proposed to her at the Kotel. Erev, that was at night, Saturday night. Sunday morning, they came to see us to introduce the girl to the grandfather, who Be'ezrat Hashem will be Masada Kedushin. Fun. I meet the girl, wonderful girl. I'm blown away. Her English is better than mine. My high. She's a lawyer. I have three lawyers in my family. If I want to sue someone, I have, wow, a whole battery of lawyers. And she writes contracts in English and Hebrew, totally. I asked her, what language do you count in? Well, at school she counts in Hebrew, but in the bank she counts in English. My high. And she told me the story. Her father is from Cherry Hill, New Jersey. I know Cherry Hill, New Jersey inside out. I was rabbi in Lower Merion, right across the bridge. Did one friend I retained from my years in the rabbinate Ilwit lives in Cherry Hill. In Cherry Hill is Nishkevena Brekel Yiddishkeit. There was no Yiddishkeit there. What are you talking about? The biggest conservative temple. These rabbi's children studied with me in BMT in gold. No Yiddishkeit. So there was this kid there from a totally assimilated family. His sisters married Goyim. And at the age of 20, this kid woke up, what's the blood in my veins? And where did he come to? It was many years ago, before Taglit, before Birthright, before everything we have today, to Yerushalayim. And here he became a Jew. And he davened in the shul, and someone in the shul said, come home with me for Kiddush. And at the Kiddush, he introduced him to his sister. So the father is American, the mother is of Persian origins, fleeing the Shah, growing up in Jerusalem. That's the girl's parents. State of Israel. The Rav is absolutely right. Transfer it to Hasidut, and you get exactly the same picture. Rabbi Yoel Cohen, right on. And we're living the miracle. Another reason to say Hallel on Yom HaTzmut. I gave some reasons on Tuesday night. Add this reason as well. And Baruch Hashem, I benefit. Just to fill in how the girl speaks English so well, it's the father then was studying for his doctorate. They had to go back to America, so she was born and spent 3 years as a little kid in America. Her first Greek language was English. Later in life, he works for Intel in Haifa. He had to go back to help in their Boston office, so she wound up in a day school in Sharon, Massachusetts. Spent another 3 years. So by that time, there is already basic English, and you can pick up two native languages. And of course, the best question is, what language do you count in? That's very interesting. When you answer, you know what your native language is. So to reiterate, I still have a little bit to go. And then I'm coming back to Yeshiva University, 1940, 41, 42, and those shiurim don't go for nothing. It's 99,000 shekel to the IOUS. Dovi, can you afford it? Do you know why the Rebbe charges for shiurim? Because if you get it for nothing, you don't value it. It's an open Gemara. Ashid the Megan Muggin Muggin Shop. Your doctor that heals for nothing is worth nothing. But on the other hand, the Rebbe never collects the money. The IU list is ripped up Erev Yom Kippur. Got it? But you got to be willing to say, Rebbe, sign me up in dignity. My dear friends, what did we do today? I hope every word I said today is true. We'll see how the word reacts. And we don't want to predict the future. Let it roll. Let it be. And halavai, 100 years from now, we'll, with great joy, because I have a lot of confidence in the Torah people, in the Jewish people, as I said yesterday at the end of this year, have a lot of confidence. Somehow it's going to work out, and it's going to work out l'kavod u'l'tiferet. So we spoke about Chabad after the Rebbe is gone, and much has been written. What keeps Chabad going? I have to say, Wertheimer's article is very fascinating. And imagine that's coming from someone who teaches at JTS, but Jack Wertheimer, you can see, has a deep understanding and appreciation for Chabad. As Ezri and Merilis all raise the same problem on, it's an interesting problem. Are they centrist? You know, it can wind up Chabad, the shuls, the rabbis all will look very black, to use popular language, but in reality, the shuls will have balabatim who are far from black, who are balabatim in the sense, not observing, driving to shul, but there's one tremendous difference from what was in the 1920s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s. No one will ever tell the rabbi what to do. They know who the rabbi is, what his responsibilities are, and the shul is the rabbi's domain. He is the boss. He is the halachist, if I can use that term. And that's a tremendous advantage. Okay, let's see how it plays out. We then, grinding down, ask the question that doesn't just refer to Chabad, but refers to all of Chassidus. If it's so true and so wonderful and so good and so positive and so intrinsic to being a Torah Jew, if you study Chabad, study Chassidus, why did it take so many hundreds or thousands of years for the secrets to be revealed? It only begins in the 18th century, the middle of the 18th century. And Rabbi Yoel Cohen gives a very powerful answer, and I made the analogy to Mori Rebbe vis-a-vis Medinat Yisrael. My dear friends, there's yet the Baruch Lichtenstein, and I'm going to show you a document that is one of a kind. Reb Shmayaru Susankin, if I'm pronouncing his name right, his grandson happens to be listening to these Sheyurim. He's in the 770 area. Show you a document, and with that, I'll say some homiletic drash to conclude 2.25 years of Sheyurim on Chabad. And then we pick up the mainstream story of the history of Torah in America, and I'm going to add to an esoteric document that was very recently published on the internet. Now, let's take care of the freebies. First of all, this is the new Sefer, and if anyone is interested, the money all goes to Shvat Ami, and they asked at the book launch to make a donation of 150 shekel, students 75, and yours truly says if anyone listening or Talmud can't afford it, whatever you donate is fine. If anyone's interested, Vic, take charge today, and you'll just take down names for me. I have copies in the office I can give you, and you give it to Yomo next week, Be'ezrat Hashem. If anyone's interested, this is personal correspondence between the Bentheim family and Rav Shai Yashiv Cohen, who just died. It goes back to 1980, and it deals with the question, can you eat in someone's home where you're not certain the kashrut is perfect? And it's a very interesting correspondence, and I corresponded with Mrs. Bentheim very recently, giving her a source on this from the Igrot Moshe. If anyone's interested, it's fascinating. Here, if anyone wants to see the greatness of Chabad, here is a $6 million Chabad Center, Shul Center, mikvah that just opened in Puerto Rico. The person who put up the funds for it is my dear student, Henry Olinsky. Among others, the Roth family is involved, and you might find this very interesting. Here is Chabad, an interview with Professor Reuven R. of Hadassah Hospital Medical Center, and you'll see the Rebbe with medical questions, and you gotta believe, let's put it that way. If anyone's interested, this is the article I referred to yesterday, that can a psychiatrist, a psychologist, a social worker, can you put your hand around a woman, a girl, to encourage them? The question that I told them the Rebbe did not have an answer, it's a riot. Here's a very interesting article that just appeared in Soha. It's contemporary. It's right now written, many sources, and you see they struggle about giving an answer. It's by Rabbi David Stav and his son, the man who could have been chief rabbi of Israel, but the right wing bitterly opposed him. This is very fascinating about a Jew who's touring in America. He's in Yellowstone National Park, and someone looks at him, it's a Chassidish looking Jew, a guy, and says, "Are you Jewish?" He says, "Yes." He says, "I've been looking for you." And he comes up with pictures that he took in World War II in the army in Shanghai, and he long since wanted to give these pictures to a Jew to identify, and at first they think it's Litvisha, and then it turns out it's Chabotnikim who were in Shanghai, and they're able to identify each one. I think only one picture isn't identified. I have a number of copies of this. It's a chance meeting in Wyoming leads to some interesting reunions. And this is unbelievable. In an Australian company is hawking sick packs of air bottled in places like Bondi Beach in Sydney, Australia. People buy it, they breathe the air, it's so good. So I want to tell you, if this New York Times, I want to tell you, in 1968 when I visited Israel, I tell you this is absolutely true, I saw cans of air from Jerusalem. So if anyone's interested, the New York Times article, this is about Wallenberg, 71 years after he vanished, they just declared him dead. This is the New York Times. Read Buba, not the Pulse. I couldn't get over this article. If you're familiar with Buba, I, thou, and I, it, the different relationships you have, he puts it into the context of the election. This is a halachic article, the New York Times. Who is your father? Who is your mother? What we have today, problems. Dr. Nancy Polyakov, that's a famous rabbinic family. Who is the father? Three women are involved, two lesbians, and there's a woman who carried the baby, the surrogate mother. Where's the semen from? Oh my gosh. The Rav once said he's happy that he's not going to be alive at a time when all the, he alluded to what's being developed, and he's happy he's not going to be alive at that time. This is an interesting article on the Gedolim. It's a little bit anti, it's evidently written by more left-wing Orthodox, but there's a nice picture in here that, believe me, never happened. Lo hayava, lo nivra. You can frame this, four gedolim. Do you recognize the picture? Where was this picture?
Sukkah.
That's the Chaim Soloveitchik. That's the Chafetz Chaim, that's the Baruch Be'er Leibovitch, and that's the Ragged Shavagon. And here they are sitting together. What you can do is unbelievable. And finally, Mark Wiener, who just went back, and next to last, Mark Wiener gave me this, had a good laugh. This is from 78, when I gave lectures for Chevret Aliyat Toranit in New York, something I helped establish through the Jewish Agency, that boys and girls can come together and hear lectures and know that everyone's interested in going on Aliyah. And we had many couples out of it, and some did go on Aliyah. By the way, Murray, that's where Normie courted Harriet at those lectures. So here you are, they were selling tapes of the lectures. I don't even recognize myself. That's a microphone I'm talking into, not a cigar. And it says the Center for Jewish Media, 48 Urban Avenue, Westbury, New York. Can anyone tell me where that is? Long Island. What the heck was I doing? How did I get to Westbury? And if anyone's interested, this is, no one here reads Hebrew, but maybe some of you do. This is the lawyer's magazine about what's going on in the legal world. My daughter always gives me, they're fascinating. I gain a lot from reading it, but what I also enjoy is look how many kippot you see and how many women with their hair covered. And if you looked at the 28 candidates for the Supreme Court, I have a feeling at least half Shomrei Torah Mitzvah 100%. I know some of them. Very impressed. Ayala Shaked. Anytime she runs for office, she gets my vote without any problem of Svera, yes or no. My dear students, I want to thank you very much for coming. Dovia, are you going to come back?
Yes.
Lisa.
Okay, so give me your name. Dovi, what's your last name?
Teitelbaum.
Teitelbaum?
Teitelbaum? Not Satmar.
But I
Teitelbaum, yeah.
Like the Satmar Rebbe.
It's L-E, the V-L.
1 second, spell it.
T-E-I-E-I-T-L-E-B-A-U-M.
So what's the difference? Do you think the Satmar Rebbe knew what he was spelling? It's some guy in when he came to America. And where are you from? Where are you from?
Florida. From Boca
Raton. And you went to the day school there?
Yeah.
Okay. You took the good out of the day school, I see. Okay, because I've heard good stories and other stories about what goes on. So I'm happy to see you took the good. Gentlemen, next day is a very fascinating Shia. Are you allowed to curse Jews who are not religious?
Right.
And you'll see from Reb Menashe Klein, there's a line there that's unbelievable. I'm going to show you the Rav, a parallel again between Reb Menashe and the Rav. Very, very powerful. And then we sail in with Jews not religious. How do we relate to Balei Tshuva and all the problems that come with it? We're going to go into a whole discussion of Reb Menashe Klein and others on some really basic problems. In this class, as I told you, we finish up the Rebbe and we shift into YU for a little while, and then we come back to the heart of what we want to speak about, the history of the rabbinate in the United States. That's my wish and prayer that anyone who needs a refuah shleima should have a refuah shleima. God should be kind to the ill, the sick. We've had enough difficulty this year, and we should go further in dignity. I want to remind everyone to say tonight, V'tein talumata levracha. Am I right? This Monday night we begin.
Maybe we'll have a rain out for the election.
No, not a rain out. Let's hope, whatever you're rooting for. I've gotten mail from people that if Trump is elected, it's the end of the world. Other people, Clinton's elected, it's the end of the world. I have confidence the world will survive. But I do want to say it's a credit to the state of Israel. I said this to my brother. My brother said, you hit the nail on the head. In this country, there's a president sitting in jail today, a prime minister sitting in jail, and a chief rabbi who will soon be sitting in jail. Credit to this country, there is basic justice. Compare this with what's going on in the United States. I don't want to elaborate. The FBI... Oh my. So it's another reason to say Hallel and Yom Ha'atzmaut. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vidanya. Thank you very much.